all of us. Everyone at the State's Academic Medical Center. All working together to deliver complete care now and for generations to come. All over the state, including hospital and clinic locations from the Delta to the Gulf Coast. All for one reason. You, the University of Mississippi Medical Center. All for your health.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
Deep South Dining is the show all about the culture of Southern flavor. From fried chicken and collard greens to shrimp and grits and a glass of sweet tea. Subscribe now to the podcast using any podcast app or download our MPB public media app.
Good morning and thanks for joining me today. You're listening to Southern Remedy, Healthy and Fit on MPB Think Radio. I'm your host, Josie Bidwell, Associate Professor of Preventive Medicine and Nurse Practitioner at the University of Mississippi Medical Center. And today we're going to be decoding diets. So I'm going to go through many of the most common dietary patterns that I get asked about in a clinical setting or that I see discussed on social media and in the actual media as well, and kind of go through what the basis behind those diets are and what any kind of limitations of those things may be. If you have a question or a comment for me, or you want to talk about your favorite way of eating, I'd love to talk with you. Send me an email, and that address is fit@mpbonline.org. All right, while I wait on some friends to get on the line with us, we're going to start with two terms that I think are often misunderstood, and that is vegetarian and vegan as eating patterns or as diets. If you've listened to me for a while, you know that in general, I don't love the word diet because it usually means some form of rules or restrictions around it, but it is a very popular term when talking about all of these eating patterns, whether it has strict rules around it or not. But in general, vegetarian and vegan can be just described as eating patterns, but some people call them diet. So what are they? What is the difference? And are they really healthy options for us? So when we start to talk about vegetarian or vegan, really we're talking about the degree of use of animal products. And when we think about animal products, probably the first thing that comes to mind is going to be meat, whether that be red meat, poultry, fish, seafood, those types of things is kind of what jumps out when you say the word animal product. But there are also other animal products like the milk from that particular animal, whether that be cow, sheep, goat, that type of thing, as well as all the products that are then made from that dairy item. So butter, sour creams, yogurts, whipped creams, cheeses, those types of items. And then there are some sneakier animal products in there. Honey is considered an animal byproduct, so we'll talk about which dietary pattern allows for that in a second. And then things like gelatin, which often come from the bones of cow, so or fish. There's also fish gelatin out there. So when we're talking about vegan versus vegetarian, a vegan dietary pattern or a vegan diet does not contain any animal products. So all of those things that I just mentioned, your meats, your fish, your seafood, your poultry, your dairy items, honey, and gelatin, all of those are absent in a vegan dietary pattern. And a vegan pattern also can extend to the lifestyle of the individual in general, where that individual does not use any animal products in anything. So all of their clothing is going to be no leather, that type of thing. Even makeups and face creams and soaps and all of that are either not tested on animals or don't have any animal byproducts in them. So it would be the most kind of restrictive in terms of animal product use. So no dairy, no eggs, no. And dairy and eggs are not the same thing. I see people get confused about that a lot. They'll be like, well, there's no eggs in this. It's dairy-free. Eggs and dairy, while stored together at the grocery store, are not the same. Not the same thing. So, but a vegan dietary pattern is going to eliminate all of those. A vegetarian pattern has some shades to it, but in the simplest sense of the word, most vegetarian patterns allow for things like honey or dairy or eggs. It's just kind of the elimination of where the animal would actually perish from that, having that food item. So the actual meat or stock made from meat, that kind of thing. And then you'll have some folks who are pescatarian, which follows largely the vegetarian way of eating, but with the addition of fish or seafood in it. So not going to have poultry or beef or lamb or any of the red meats or porks. And so, you know, all that to say, is there support for these dietary patterns, and is it something that you should be doing? Well, I can't answer if it's something you should be doing, right? That's a decision that you have to make for yourself in terms of, you know, your personal beliefs and then also health, health needs as well. When done well, when well planned, vegetarian, vegan, or pescatarian ways of eating can be very well balanced and can meet all of your nutrient needs, as well as be good for your heart and your liver and your kidneys and all these organs that we're trying to protect. But just labeling something vegan or vegetarian does not necessarily mean it is a super healthy food that we should eat more of. You know, that's how I like to talk about foods in general, as things we need to eat more of and things we need to eat less of, not things that we have to avoid completely, because all foods can fit into a well-balanced dietary pattern. But my favorite example is Oreos. Oreos are just as vegan as they want to be and are also delicious, but not something that I want to eat. Well, I do kind of want to eat it all the time. They're delicious, but not something that I'm going to choose to eat every day or in large quantities, because they are full of sugar and fat and are not what my body needs, right? My body needs some good nutrients. It may want an Oreo, and that's fine. But again, just because it is quote-unquote vegan does not mean it is a health food. One of my other favorite foods, French fries. French fries are delicious, but usually are not something that we need to eat every day or even every other day. And those are absolutely vegetarian unless they are fried in like duck fat or some kind of animal fat. They're also usually vegan as well. But again, not something that we want to eat tons of or eat super regularly. So when thinking about should I eat this way, we always want to err on the side of eating the wholest food possible, right? Things that haven't been messed with as much, and that we kind of can still recognize what it started out in life, and then decide whether we want to completely eliminate animal products, have smaller amounts of them, or make them a feature of our plate at every meal. And again, we can build balanced ways of eating in each one of those particular scenarios. So I hope that kind of clears it up a little bit. I know it can be really confusing when you hear those terms and you think I have to eat this way to be healthy, and you don't. What we want to focus on is balanced eating. Now, you've heard me talk on the show plenty about whole food plant-based eating or whole food plant predominant eating, and that one gets confused with vegan and vegetarian very, very frequently, and they are not the same for the same reason that I just mentioned before, in the fact that just because something is free of animal products does not necessarily mean it is a super healthy food item, because those foods I just mentioned, like French fries and Oreos, would would count as free of animal products, but would not necessarily fall into a whole food plant-based or plant-predominant way of eating. So what is a whole food plant-based or plant-predominant way? Well, that is, again, where we're going to choose things that have not been messed with as much, the wholer food option. And the majority of that plate is going to be plants. It can be completely plants, or it can be what I like to say is about 3/4 of the plate as plant-based foods, and then that other quarter of the plate can be more plants, or it can be an animal-based product here as well. And limiting what I call one animal at a time. If you're going to have an animal-based product on your plate, think about how many sources of animal-based products do we have at this meal, and try and keep the to one ideally, because everything comes with other nutrients, and animal products often come with more saturated fat or salt added to them. So just being mindful of that particular pattern. What whole food plant-based is not is vegan or vegetarian. It is just a focus on the plants as the predominant nutrient source, which also goes right on along with regular guidelines for Americans. If you think about the Choose My Plate feature that is part of the USDA recommendations for nutrients for Americans, and you look at that plate, half of it is fruits and vegetables, a quarter of it is a starch or grain, and all of those are plant-based foods, and then a quarter of that plate is listed as protein, and that can be an animal-based protein like meat, pork, poultry, fish, seafood, or a plant-based source of protein like a bean, nut, seed, legume, that type of thing. So whole food plant predominant is not that different than just a regular, well-balanced plate. I know we did a show a couple weeks back on how you build that healthy plate. So if you want to learn all about each one of those different parts of the plate and some examples of those different foods and how you make that fit into your lifestyle, I encourage you to go back and listen to that episode. You can find that by searching for Southern Remedy on your favorite podcasting app and downloading that episode. Thanks for tuning in this morning. You're listening to Southern Remedy Healthy and Fit on MPB Think Radio. I'm your host, Josie Bidwell, Associate Professor of Preventive Medicine at UMMC. And we're going through some dietary patterns today and trying to decode these diets. What do they actually mean when you see those words out there? What is on those dietary patterns? What would push you away from that particular dietary pattern? And then also, is there any evidence to support the use of that way of eating in progressing your health? If you have a question or a comment or want to share your favorite recipe or food that you have adopted on a healthy eating pattern, all right, in the first segment of the show, we talked about vegan, vegetarian, and whole food plant-based or plant-predominant eating. And you may go, well, why do you always clarify when you say plant-based versus plant-predominant? Well, because there can be the misconception that plant-based means only plants, and really it's predominance of plants, so the majority of that plate as plant-based foods, which I find to be very freeing in terms of being able to build a plate that is full of fiber and micronutrients and all the things that my body needs while still allowing for some areas of your favorite foods in there. When we put really rigid boxes around foods, it kind of makes our brain crave that. When we're like, well, I can't have any of this particular item, our brain can fixate on that and make it much harder to stay on that way of eating. I'm very much a plant predominant way eater, and the majority of my plates are always pretty much all plants. But just by kind of giving myself that freedom to know that if I needed to have a little animal product on this plate, it's going to be okay, helps me not stress about my food. And we don't want to be stressing about our food as much as possible. You know, I've talked on the show about balance before and how a healthy lifestyle that promotes proper functioning of our body is more than just nutrition. It's about balance among all the areas of lifestyle, physical activity, managing our stress, having good restorative sleep, reduction of those risky substances like tobacco and alcohol, and then fostering social connection. And we can overcorrect in certain areas and throw us kind of out of balance in others. If I wind up being super preoccupied about the perfectness of my plate, that often means I'm going to miss out on social engagements because I'm worried about what foods will be there, or if there's going to be something compliant with my diet or my way of eating. And that's stray into an area that is not healthy. And so we want to make the best decisions that we can and kind of move on, right? The other thing I see happen a lot of times when people are trying to follow a diet is if there's nothing there that is quote unquote compliant for that diet, they just don't eat. And skipping meals is also not healthy and not balanced. And so we want to strike the middle road of building meals and snacks and patterns that help support our health, but that don't stress us out too much, right? So that we truly enjoy food, because food is delicious and can be there to be enjoyed as well. All right, let's talk about the DASH diet. It is one that I think a lot of people have heard of. Whenever I give talks, I am always a little surprised that more people have not heard of the DASH diet, as it's been around for a very long time, and stands for Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension. So that's what the DASH stands for. I think it's a cute little play on words because it also sounds like you're dashing salt. And we think about salt as it relates to high blood pressure. But the cool thing about the DASH way of eating, obviously it was developed and studied to help treat hypertension, which is high blood pressure. But the basis of that dietary pattern is good for all health conditions. So I see it prescribed a lot for people with high blood pressure, but you don't have to have high blood pressure to adopt a DASH way of eating. It is just good foundational, heart healthy ways of eating. But at the basis of it, it is focusing on vegetables, fruits, and whole grains, which sounds very similar to what I just talked about in just a well-balanced plate. Half of the plate is fruits and vegetables, a quarter as a starch or a grain. The DASH diet also includes fat-free or low-fat dairy products, fish, poultry, beans, nuts, and vegetable oils. And so you may go, vegetable oils, that doesn't sound super healthy. My particular stance on vegetable oils is that we shouldn't be using enough vegetable oils that it really matters which one we're choosing. The reason that vegetable oils are kind of recommended or promoted on the DASH way of eating is because it is a better option than a solid fat like butter or Crisco, lard, something like that, in terms of saturated versus unsaturated fat. So replacing the butter with olive oil, avocado oil, something like that is going to be a better swap in terms of saturated fat, which is linked to worse heart health. But at the end of the day, I always ask, does this thing need oil? Does it need an added fat added into it? And if not, then I'm not going to add an oil into that particular food. And so, you know, one tablespoon of added oil throughout the day, I'm not going to get that hung up on which kind of source it's coming from in terms of, you know, avocado, olive, canola, corn, peanut, those types of things. Very small amount of oil is what we should be focusing on. And then also elimination of tropical oils. So palm oil and coconut oil are saturated fats. And so those would be not prioritized on the DASH way of eating, because again, those saturated fats are what we're trying to kind of stay away from in terms of our heart health. And then limiting sugar sweetened beverages and sweets. So what I think confuses a lot of people is there are multiple names for basically the same dietary patterns, right? So this whole food plant predominant way of eating, the DASH way of eating, the foundational aspects of all of these are the same. It is prioritizing fruits, veggies, grains, and then deprioritizing saturated fat, and making sure our protein choices are lean choices, whether that be from something like fish or poultry or something like beans, nuts, seeds, that type of thing. Is the DASH diet doable? Yes, DASH diet's also relatively inexpensive to implement because there are no kind of special foods that you need to have to do the DASH diet. It's just regular foods, it just in proper proportions of those things. And it tends to be less, again, restrictive because it's not really a food that's off limits. It's just less of these things and more of these other things. So less of our saturated fat and red meats, more of our fruits, veggies, grains, and unsaturated fats, and then limiting those added sugar sweetened beverages, whether that be a soda, whether that be the world famous sweet tea that we indulge in down here in the South, or things like sports drinks and juice, which if we can just kind of camp out there for a second and talk about sugar sweetened beverages. I work with obviously a lot of people who are trying to get better control of their blood sugar and maybe consuming a variety of different beverage choices. And most folks realize that the regular sodas probably need to go down or go away if we're trying to control our blood sugar. But I often see people swap it one for one with a sports drink. So like an electrolyte drink, like a Gatorade, Powerade, that kind of thing. And that is not necessarily needed, right? Those beverages were created mainly to replace electrolytes in people who are being very physically active and losing a lot of sweat and a lot of electrolytes through that physical activity, whether that be during a sporting event, working out in, you know, the blazing heat for hours on end, that type of thing. Most of those sports beverages are going to come with a fair amount of sugar. Sugar is not an electrolyte. Okay, so what those drinks have that we may need are things like sodium and potassium and chloride and those types of things to help replenish the losses that we have from sweat. And if we are really out there for more than an hour or we're doing some type of endurance sport, that kind of thing, we may need the glucose or the sugar because we're not eating during those particular events. But your average person that is not engaging in those things and are just replacing that soda with a sports beverage is not going to see kind of the full benefit of that switch from a sugar standpoint. So you could absolutely switch to a zero calorie version of that. You know, I don't love artificial sweeteners, but if we're trying to control our sugar, that may be a way to go. But the full sugar variety of those is probably not going to push us closer where we want to be. And then juice as well. And everybody gets mad at me because they're like, but juice is a fruit. And you just told me I needed to prioritize my fruit. And, you know, let me explain it a little bit, right? So one of the reasons that fruit is prioritized on all of these dietary patterns is because there are vitamins and minerals in there that we need that we often don't get from any other sources, especially if we're not eating vegetables too. But the biggest reason is for the fiber. Fiber is a beautiful thing, and I've been hearing people say 2024 is the year of fiber, and that makes me very happy. I would like that on a t-shirt. But fiber has no calories. It does not contribute to weight gain, right? It does wonderful things in our gut in terms of feeding our good gut bacteria to make our little gut microbiome happy, which is linked to better brain health, better heart health, better mental performance, better immunity in terms of your immune system function and not catching as many colds and that type of thing. The other thing that fiber does really well is help lower cholesterol and decrease your risk for colon cancer. So I agree 2024 should be the year of fiber as well as all the other years to come. But that is one of the main drivers of why fruit is a really healthy addition, because fiber is really bulky, takes up room in your stomach, slows your digestion down so that you don't have such a spike in blood sugar following the consumption of that particular food item. And when we juice a fruit, we tend to just squeeze out the water, sugar, and nutrients and throw away the fiber. So an 8-ounce glass of orange juice, to get that amount of juice, we would need to juice between like 3 and 4 oranges to get there. So if we think about how quickly you can drink a glass of orange juice. You can drink a glass in like a minute, right? You're not going to be full from that. And that's the same kind of calories and sugar content from four of those oranges versus if I peeled those oranges for you and set those four oranges out and said, just eat till you're full, you probably wouldn't be able to eat all four of those oranges before you were like, ooh, I'm done. Like, I'm all full of oranges. And so it's not that juice is unhealthy. It's just that it loses its kind of nutritional powerhouse, which is the fiber, and it allows you to consume a larger amount of calories without feeling full and satisfied. And then that's kind of the point of food is to make you feel full and satisfied while delivering the nutrients that your body needs to it. So, again, that DASH pattern is prioritizing fruits, veggies, grains, fish, poultry, beans, nuts, and seeds, and then reducing saturated fats as well as sugar-sweetened beverages. You're listening to Southern Remedy Healthy and Fit on MPB Think Radio. I'm your host, Josie Bidwell, nurse practitioner at UMMC, and we're decoding some diets today and really going through some really popular terms and diets out there and going through what they actually mean and whether they should be part of your healthy journey. The Mediterranean diet has been winning year after year in terms of being named the top diet or best diet according to U.S. News and World Report. So why is that? Well, one of the reasons is that it is pretty balanced, right, in terms of what it is promoting, as well as it is easier to maintain. So from a sustainability standpoint, which is always something that I'm looking for in terms of being your lifestyle medicine provider, it's not something like that I don't look at what can I put you on for 4 to 6 weeks to help you lose weight or get control of your blood pressure, any of these kinds of things. I always tell my patients, I'm playing the long game, right? Like I'm trying to help you establish a pattern of living that includes balanced nutrition and the other areas of lifestyle that you're going to be happy and satisfied with for the long term. That when you're 30 years down the road, you're going to still be eating according to these principles, right? Not going on and off certain diets. And so the Mediterranean diet is one that people tend to stick to more often. And even can have a little bit more affordability, even though sometimes we think of the Mediterranean diet as being very fish heavy and very olive oil heavy, which are two very expensive ingredients. When you actually look at the frequency of the fish or the seafood on the Mediterranean diet, it's just a few times a week. The notion that we have to have a meat or an animal every day is much more of an American way of eating. More of the Mediterranean way is actually focusing on those plant-based proteins like the beans and the legumes and those types of things, and then having fish or seafood or even poultry a few times a week there, and very, very rarely on the red meat train. So that's why it can be a more affordable way of eating as well. All right, before we dig into it a little bit more, we do have a caller on the line, so I'm going to say good morning, Tom. How can I help you?
Yes, I have a question. I'm
sure.
In my late 70s.
Okay.
And when I went to the dentist the other day, my hygienist asked me if I was taking blood thinners. I do not take any medication other than a statin. Don't take aspirin. Don't take blood thinners. And it seems like my gums were bleeding pretty easily.
Okay.
So my question is, I eat very little red meat. Most of my protein comes from either vegetable, which is beans, or seafood. I eat some chicken, but not very often anymore. So my question is there any foods that could create where I might be bleeding more, or is there some foods I should be eating that would help do the coagulation better?
Yeah, absolutely. So usually gum bleeding during a dental cleaning is just going to be because of kind of bacteria around the gum line and some kind of inflammation of the gums that make them bleed more. And it often looks like a whole lot of blood when in reality it's not a super amount of it. But if we kind of focus in on the actual question, so some foods that we tend to not necessarily associate, or supplements even, that can prolong bleeding, like fish oil can actually thin our blood a little bit. Large amounts of garlic and ginger, especially in supplement form, can also do that. I wouldn't think it's kind of anything that you're having in your dietary pattern, just kind of listening to what you're saying that you're eating, that would necessarily be making your blood thinner. Vitamin K-rich foods have been shown to help with blood clotting. And so vitamin K-rich foods are normally your green leafy vegetables and those types of things. It sounds like your dietary pattern is pretty well balanced, Tom, and made me smile a little bit. So if it does nothing else today, you should be, you know, that I smiled when you told me what what you were eating there. So I don't necessarily think it's a food issue for you that was leading to that, that gum bleeding there.
Well, I just wondered if maybe I needed to supplement or put a little more red meat in my diet for the iron or something along that line.
You know, and that's a common thought among people. Having more iron is not necessarily going to make you clot faster or any of those kinds of things. It just is going to have to do with how much oxygen your blood is able to carry around in terms of anemia. So I think we would need to look at kind of your overall health history. You mentioned that you're on a statin, so that tells me we've got some high cholesterol, or we're trying to prevent heart disease from that standpoint. And we have to be careful when we add red meats in, because they are usually the fattier portions of it. If it's something that you feel like you do need to add back in, then I would obviously choose the least processed versions of those that you can, where it's just actually starting with that red meat item. But I don't think that you necessarily need that. You could absolutely get more iron in your diet from plant-based sources. Like you mentioned, beans are a wonderful source of iron, as are those green leafy vegetables that I mentioned. Those are really good sources of iron. Now, a little hack is increasing your vitamin C content when you're eating foods that have iron in them, because it helps with the absorption of that iron. And we tend to think about juice, like orange juice, as being your vitamin C champion. But actually, my favorite is going to be like a red or yellow pepper, like bell pepper. So having a good salad with some nice leafy greens, and then throwing some bell peppers in there, is a great way to pair an iron-rich food with a vitamin C-rich food to help with the absorption. All right.
Okay, well, that answers my question. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you for your program.
Absolutely. I appreciate you giving me a call today. You have a great rest of your Monday. All right. And so I think now is kind of a good time to kind of recap the main dietary patterns that I went over today: vegan, vegetarian, whole food, plant-based, DASH, Mediterranean. I didn't go into paleo a lot, but that is another one that I get asked about very frequently, the Paleolithic diet. Obviously, the way it was marketed was eat the way cave people ate, but when you actually look at a list of all the things that are allowed on a Paleolithic diet, there is wine on there, and I don't necessarily think that that was a beverage of choice back then. But the commonalities on the paleo way of eating is a focus on fruits and veggies. What it does not endorse are grains and beans and legumes. So I have a hard time really getting behind that, because there are so many nutrients that we do need in certain grains and beans and legumes, and the health-promoting properties of those in terms of blood sugar control and overall heart health. But at the basis of the paleo diet is a focus on vegetables and grains, and then leaner choices of meat. A lot of times when people hear paleo, they think, "Ooh, I'm going to have all the meat," right? And that's actually not what most paleo diets recommend. They are very heavy in your non-starchy vegetables, and then do allow for some tubers, so some potatoes and those types of things. It's just mainly the elimination of grains and beans. So through all of those patterns right there that we've talked about, it can be confusing, but I hope that what you've heard is they all have an underlying theme of fruits and vegetables. Like, all of them are talking about eating fruits and vegetables. And when I step back and look at the dietary pattern of Americans and what we're actually eating, we are not eating those things, right? We have very, overall, very low fruit and vegetable content. One of my favorite slides that I show when I go and do talks on nutrition is a pie chart that shows the distribution of where the calories come from in the American diet. And about 60 to 65% comes from processed food items. About 25% comes from animal-based foods. And then we have this little 12% of the pie that comes from plant foods. And when you're looking at this pie graph, that little wedge is green, and half of that wedge is light green and the other half is dark green. And that's because half of that 12% of plant foods comes from things like apples and apple pie, or vegetables that may be in small amounts but stirred into other casseroles, or the fruit in Pop-Tarts and those kinds of things. So only about 6% of those calories are coming from whole plants. So when you're thinking about how should I be eating or what diet should I be doing to promote heart health, all of them recommend fruits and vegetables. Very few Americans are actually eating the number of fruits and vegetables. So my number one recommendation is always going to be, how do we get one more, right? Regardless of where you stand in your fruit and vegetable intake, how do we get one more? Whether that be one is all you get, right? That's better than none. Or maybe you're already getting three or four servings. How do we get one more? Right, because those are the most nutrient-dense items that we can add to our diet to help with weight maintenance or weight loss, with blood sugar control, with heart health control, with gut health, all of those different kinds of things. So if you learn nothing else today, it's find a way to have a fruit or a vegetable. And it does not have to be fresh, right? It can be frozen. It can be canned. We just have to make them fit, and we can absolutely do that and exist within your budgetary constraints or picky eaters or all of those different kinds of things and try and make those fit in your life. You're listening to Southern Remedy Healthy and Fit on MPB Think Radio. I'm your host, Josie Bidwell, nurse practitioner at UMMC. We've been decoding some diets today, and we've been through the majority of the ones that you think about in terms of dietary patterns. And this last segment of the show, I want to talk about intermittent fasting. I continue to get questions about intermittent fasting. I gave a talk the other day, and I would probably say a third of the questions that were posted in the Zoom chat had to do with intermittent fasting. And so let's talk about what it is and what it is not, right? So intermittent fasting can be put into one of kind of two buckets. We can have time-restricted eating, or we can have calorie-restricted eating that goes along with intermittent fasting. If we just break down the words, fasting usually means not having any calories, and then intermittent is going to be some time frame. And there are kind of three main types. Now, there are many, many more, but there are three kind of main types of intermittent fasting. One is called 16-8, which is speaking to a 16-hour fast and an 8-hour feeding window, meaning you consume your calories during a certain 8 hours, and then you have no calories the other 16 hours. You usually can have things like water and zero-calorie beverages and that kind of thing. Then there is the 5-2, and that refers to different days. So 5 days of the week, you would have your kind of normal caloric intake. And then on 2 days of the week, you would have a significantly reduced calorie intake, usually down to about 30% of what your calorie goal is. So somewhere in the 500 to 600 calorie range. And then there's something called alternate day fasting, which is where you would not have any calories on certain days. So it may be that on Monday you have your normal calories, Tuesday you don't take in any or take in very, very, very small amount of those particular things, and still having, water and things for hydration that are zero calorie. Now, That's what it is. What it is not is just meal skipping. And that is what I see happen a lot when I start to do a dietary assessment on patients that come to see me. I do two things to start out with. I have like a little screening tool that I do that basically just asks about the frequency of consuming different foods like fruits and vegetables or fast food and that kind of thing. And then I do a 24-hour diet recall where I literally ask you to kind of go back to the last 24 hours and walk me through what you have for breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks, beverages, desserts, that kind of thing. And a lot of times I will see a blank on the breakfast one. It'll just have nothing there. And I'm like, okay, tell me about breakfast. Are we not eating because we're not hungry? Or what are we trying to do right here? And the vast majority of the time, people tell me it's because I'm intermittent fasting. And I'll say, tell me what that looks like for you. Because I can see what we've written down for the other part of the 24 hours. And it's often not going to be a well-balanced, calorie-balanced dietary pattern. All we've done is skip that breakfast, right? Which is not necessarily what we're striving for, right? One of the things that intermittent fasting, at least from a 16:8 perspective, is trying to do is help you burn through the foods that you eat. So when we eat all day long, like from the time we get up in the morning till the time we go to bed at night, you know, an extended, you know, kind of 12 hours of munching, right? And then we're also not doing any type of physical activity that's going to help expend or burn through some of those calories, then we may not burn through all of the calories from the meal before we have the next meal. And so it can be hard to lose weight in that way of eating, right? We burn more calories when we are awake. Like me right now, per hour, I'm burning more calories, even though I'm sitting, right? But I'm using my hands, I'm talking, I'm writing, doing all these kinds of things. I'm going to burn more calories per hour than when I go to sleep, right? I'm going to burn less calories when I'm asleep. So when we push the bulk of our calories to the end of the day, and then we go to bed, it makes it very hard to burn through all of those calories before we wake up the next day and have breakfast. So that's why some folks will start their feeding window a little later in the day so that they can continue to burn through those calories before we have breakfast. I tend to recommend shifting that. If we're going to do some type of intermittent fasting, then I would push the calories more toward the front end of the day. So I would have breakfast, I would have lunch, I would have dinner, I would just have dinner a little earlier. So if bedtime is 10 p.m., then I'm not going to be eating dinner at 8:30 or 9, right? I'm going to try and push that more to like 6 p.m., right? When we think about it, that is kind of a more normal pattern of eating when we have breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and we're done with dinner earlier on in the evening. That way I burn through those calories before I go to sleep, and then in the morning I'm ready for breakfast, okay? The alternate day or the 5-2 day, one of the reasons the 5-2 will actually work and is not just, again, only having one meal a day or skipping a lot of your meals is because when you do that consistently, right, and a lot of my patients come and they are only eating one time a day, not necessarily because they're trying to do some kind of fast, but that's just what they have adopted over time, whether it be from busy schedules or whatnot. When we do that every single day, our body adjusts to realize that you're only going to feed it once. And so your metabolic rate's going to slow down and you're really not going to lose weight. You may even gain weight. When you're doing something like a 5-2 fast, on the days that you're eating plenty of calories, a well-balanced diet, and then the next day you're eating a much fewer calories, which your body's going to go, that's weird for today, but it's not going to slow that metabolic rate down. And then we feed it regularly again the next day. So all that to say, intermittent fasting can be a tool, but it should be a tool that's done in conjunction with your healthcare provider. And there are certain people who shouldn't do it. People who have had eating disorders, people who are pregnant, children, people with type 1 diabetes, all of those folks, I would not recommend intermittent fasting for. It's just not the pattern that we want to adopt there. But always make dietary changes in conjunction with your healthcare provider so that we can make sure that they are truly going to be nourishing your body and your mind while helping to control your medical conditions that we have. All right, we are out of time for today. You've been listening to Southern Remedy Healthy and Fit. If you didn't get your question in today or you want to know more about anything I talked about, you can always email me, fit@mpbonline.org. You can go back and listen to this show by searching for Southern Remedy on your favorite podcasting app. Go ahead and download that and click your notifications. That way you will never miss an episode of Southern Remedy. And you've been listening to Southern Remedy Healthy and Fit on MPB Think Radio.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.